Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths. I'm Yada. Each weekday we strive to expose the destructive myths associated with religion and politics, patriotism in the media, and military and economic schemes. Instead of merely presenting the news, our mission is to understand what is actually occurring while predicting how these events will shape our world. Then, during our second hour, we engage God on His terms through evidence and reason, since His is the lone reliable voice in an exceedingly troubled world. We encourage you to participate in this discussion. Over the next 2 hours, you can call us toll-free, 877-300-7645. Noticed in the news that the Congress wants to bellyache about the IRS probing conservative charities, if you will, charity political support groups out of their Cincinnati office, but nobody wants a special prosecutor. Call me cynical, but my intuition here tells me that the issue with the senators and the congressmen is that with Americans, particularly those that make donations to their campaigns, taxed to death, and the economy in turmoil, and them responsible for the mess that they have created of the U.S. economy, it probably isn't a good idea for them to flaunt the fact that their personal playground is tax-exempt, that contributions to their campaigns and to all of their personal indulgences are not taxed. I don't think it would go over real well with the American people if they considered that those who are destroying the U.S. economy and who have regulated and taxed it to death aren't very well regulated and simply aren't taxed on their own. Maybe if they played by the same rules, the rules might be different. Yesterday we were covering a story about Pope Francis and his potential exorcism. And the one thing I did not explain, and I do want to go over, and there's more insights on the particular story and on Roman Catholicism fascinations with exorcisms. But the one thing I promised to do that I did not do yesterday is explain how it is possible that that Christians who have no relationship with God can perform exorcisms. Now, yesterday we read Yosha telling us this would be the case, that Christians who do not know him, calling him Lord, would be summarily excluded from heaven, that anyone calling God Lord is excluded from heaven. That's what he said. And he then said that that not listening to him, which is typical of Christians, they repeat Lord, Lord to him after he tells them that if you call him Lord, you're excluded from heaven. And then they say, and by the way, so much for the, you know, he knows who I'm talking to. You know, you don't get to get so fixated on his name. He knows that when I use Jesus, who I'm talking to. Well, so much for that myth with the statement that Yosha made in the Sermon on the Mount. But he then listens to them say, but, you know, we did, we wrote and said, you know, inspired utterances in your name. No, your books and your sermons, they weren't inspired. And you most certainly didn't present them in my name. Then they said, we drove out demons in your name. No, you didn't drive out demons in my name. And then they said, but we built these mighty institutions and did mighty things that we created in your name. All, of course, was in direct contradiction to what God's role is relative to our lives. It is God who inspires revelations, not men. It is God who keeps the demonic influence away from us, not us driving them out. We don't have any control over them. And third, this notion that we are to do mighty works is the opposite of God's perspective, who is the one who does mighty works to save us, to improve and enhance his relationship with his covenant children. Now, as it relates to the second item in that list, most of the time that God speaks of exorcisms, and there is none in the Torah, prophets, and Psalms, but there are several in the historic accounts. But most of the time that this is discussed, it's in the it's in a discussion with false prophets, of those who are excluded from him. So what you have to recognize is, okay, these people do not know God. God's made that very clear. He says, I do not know you. You do not know me. Get out of here. So they have no relationship with him, but they have witnessed demons being expelled, and they have done so. So how did they do so when they have absolutely no relationship with God? How does a Christian, how does the Roman Catholic Church identify and cast out demons when they have no relationship with God? We ought not be stumped here. The Lord, the very name, the title that these Christians are using wrongly when they approach Yahusha, is Satan. Paul, who's the founder of the Christian religion, said that he was demon-possessed. He said that Satan's messengers controlled him. He spoke of the Lord, and his God is modeled after Satan's ambition. So, who is empowering Christians? The Lord. And when the Lord, they even say they're casting out demons in the Lord's name, doesn't Satan have control over those spirits who rebelled along with him? And so, what easier way is there for Satan to fool the gullible than to have his demons be cast out of somebody? What does it cost him? It cost him nothing. I mean, this idea that that a demon who is cast out is somehow destroyed is nonsense. The spiritual messengers, whether they be good or bad, are eternal. They just go someplace else. It doesn't. He loses nothing, but he gets a great show when someone who has mistaken him for God is empowered by him to cast out one of his own. But then you might say, what? One of the times when Yahusha cast out demons, he said that a house divided cannot stand when questioned as to how he could have power over them, because they assumed the logical explanation. Well, the explanation one I just showed you, the explanation which is that, of course, the Lord has control over demons. They work for him. And so those who knew the adversarial relationship immediately at that day said, well, you know, if you're casting them out, you know, you must be associated with them. The logical analysis, the one that Christians can't make here, is one that people of that day quickly made. And Yahusha gave a very interesting comment. He said, a house divided cannot stand. And so the inference for Christians is, well, the only way that you can cast out demons is to be opposed to them, because if you're a divided house, you can't stand. That is really a clever comment, because what he's saying is that yes, he has the power to cast out demons. Yes, Satan has the power to cast out demons. But when a house separated, and Satan's house is separated from God, the demonic house is separated from God, it will not stand. And it will. It's going to crumble. And so God is making the distinction here that all demonic activity is separated from him, and that ultimately it will not stand. He didn't say it's going to die, because they're not going to die. They're going to ultimately be banished to Sheol, a place that's infinite in time. They'll be incarcerated. And so it was a brilliant answer. He's talking about the difference between him and them, and ultimately their fate. And so when you see Satan casting out demons in the name of the Lord, when Christians perform that rite, you ought to recognize, yeah, it's a flashy show. But a house that works against itself that way is not going to stand. That's how we can come to understand this, because it obviously is confusing Christians. That's why he recites that will be one of their three explanations as to why they thought that they were on his side. They're just beguiled. They were fooled. Returning to the article, experts say that Francis' frequent invocation of the devil is a reflection both of his Jesuit spirituality and his Latin American roots. Now, it's true that in Latin America, Catholicism is really very different. That's why it's so surprising that the Roman Catholic Church would accept their first ever Latin American pope. because in throughout South America, in Brazil and Mexico and Argentina, the old influences of the religion of the Incas, the Mayas, the Aztecs, and other tribes still are intermixed within Roman Catholicism. And with those religions, there was a significant demonic component to them. And so they amalgamated pagan Roman Catholic religion, but Roman Catholic religion is a pagan religion. But this amalgamation of the unique proclivities of the native populations of South America has created a really toxic blend. And so it is why Francis has such a preoccupation with the devil. There is this, also if you read this article, it says that there is a direct relationship between the weakening of Christianity and the fascination with the devil. This is a quote now from Robert Gall, who is a moral theologian for Rome's Pontifical Holy Cross University. He says, quote, "The devil's influence and presence in the world seems to fluctuate in quantity inversely proportionate to the presence of the Christian faith." So what he's saying is when the Christian faith is pervasive and no one is allowed to do anything outside of the approval of the Roman Catholic Church, that you don't see the devil. But when Roman Catholicism loses its control and there's lots of people that are outside the auspices of Roman Catholicism, you see the devil popping up everywhere. Now, what that tells me, if it's true, is that while his minions, those in Christianity who have mistakenly adopted the Lord, who is Satan, as their God, are in control, there's really nothing Satan needs to do. He's got the world on a string. He's got Muslims praying to him five times a day, and he's got Christians doing his bidding. I mean, he can go off and take a siesta. Not much he needs to do. But when Christianity loses its influence, then there's work to do. And our deceitful one is a busy boy again. We'll return to this story on exorcism and devils in Roman Catholicism. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're considering the influence of the devil in Roman Catholicism, demons, devils, and popes, oh my. This fellow, Robert Gould, who is the moralist for Rome's Pontifical Holy Cross University. Boy, there's a whole lot of paganism right there. Holy, Pontifical, Cross, and Rome, as well as theologian. He is certainly full of it up to his eyeballs. He writes, "So one would expect an upswing of malicious activity in the wake of de-Christianization and secularization." Now, why would that be the case? You know, if that's what Satan wants, why would that be the case? Why wouldn't he just be laying back and saying, "Hey, man, you know, I got the secularists now in charge of the world. You know, they run most governments, they run most universities. I've got them indoctrinating people to deny God's existence. I've got them focused on the creation rather than the creator. It's just perfect. I'll go take a siesta, man. But maybe I'll need a sabbatical." That's the problem with religion is it makes people irrational. Anyway, he went on to say that in a world and a surge in things like drug use, pornography, and superstition, why didn't he say pedophilia? Because I guess that would be hitting too close to Roman Catholicism. Now, why do you think that the devil would be in the drug business? Why do you think he'd be in the pornography business? Why would he be in the superstition business? Isn't that just people doing what people are prone to do? Estranged from God? Do you think that the devil is such a micromanager that he's out there saying, "Hey, little boy, why don't you become a drug dealer? Or, hey, little girl, why don't you become a porn star? Are we really that dense that we suspect that Satan is omnipresent and doing all of that sort of thing, micromanaging our world? Is he to blame for everything that we don't like? In recent years, Rome's pontifical universities have hosted several courses for would-be exorcists on the right. Updated in 1998 and contained in the Little Red Book, the rite, relatively brief, consisting of blessings of holy water. Holy water, by the way, is purely Babylonian. It is pagan. Prayers, something that God does never ask for in his Torah. Not once in his Torah does God say, you know, I need you to pray to me. Never once. And an interrogation of the devil. Now, God doesn't say that we should interrogate the devil. He tells us, really, we should ignore him. He wants us actually to question him. That's right. Wants us to question him. Wants us to consider the evidence that he's provided and then seek answers. Which means that you're questioning him. That's what he wants. So they've got it all upside down, but that's the nature of religion. And an interrogation of the devil in which the exorcist demands to know the devil's name and how many are present and when they will leave the victim. It's kind of funny, isn't it? So the devil is supposed to be the prince of lies. And yet you're asking the devil for a name. What's the odds that if he is the prince of lies, that these demons are going to tell you the truth? And if you're having to ask them to leave and you're saying, hey, when would you, are you considering leaving? Doesn't that suggest that you have absolutely no influence over them? You ask them how many there are. And it suggests that you don't have any way to tell. Really funny, isn't it? It says only a priest, of course, is authorized by a bishop can perform an exorcism. So why do they give classes on it? And canon law, which is, of course, the church's rules, specifies that the exorcist must be endowed with piety, knowledge, prudence, and integrity of life. You know, there's a lot of Roman Catholic priests that embody those characteristics. I'm sure that's what they all tell themselves as they're molesting little children. The Reverend Giulio Maspero, a Rome-based systemic theologian, that's a fancy term, who has witnessed or participated in more than a dozen exorcisms, says that he's fairly certain that Francis's prayer on Sunday was either a full-fledged exorcism or a simple prayer to liberate the young man from demonic possession. Now, of course, the Pope says, no, that's not what happened. I didn't make a prayer to liberate him from demonic possession. And there's no evidence that he was liberated from anything. All the guy did is slump in his wheelchair. He's still in his wheelchair. There's no evidence that any demons fled him. And yet, the Reverend Maspero says, oh, having witnessed them, I can tell with absolute certainty or near certainty that the Pope exorcised a demon. Now, by the way, the expert said there were four demons and that he couldn't exorcise them. We'll be back in a moment. Hello, and welcome back to Shattering Myths. I'm your host, Yada. If you're familiar with the role that Goebbels played for Adolf Hitler in the Third Reich, Federico Lombardi has that same role for the Roman Catholic Church. This article says the Vatican spokesman, the Reverend Federico Lombardi, sought to temper speculation on what occurred or that it was a exorcism. While he did not deny it outright, of course, he loves the suspicion that this pope might have some significant influence over demons. He said that Francis hadn't intended to perform one. He stressed that the intention of the person praying is quite important. Important for what? The intention of the person is important. Why? And if something happened that he didn't intend, what would that mean? He's supposed to be, you know, God's witness here on earth. I mean, tell me he doesn't know what he's doing? He doesn't know the consequence of his thoughts or actions? Is that what you're saying, Mr. Lombardi? That said, Francis' actions and attitude towards the devil are not new. As Archbishop of Buenos Aires, the former Cardinal Jorge Mario Bergoglio frequently spoke about the devil in our midst. In the book Heaven and Earth, Bergoglio devoted the second chapter to the devil and said in no uncertain terms that he believes that the devil and that Satan's fruits are destruction, division, hatred, and calumny. So if you hate, that is of the devil. But God hates. So are you saying that Yahweh is of the devil? God says frequently, I hate. In fact, it is impossible to love unless you hate. If you don't hate that which is injurious to those you love, you aren't loving. Hate is an absolute requirement for love. Just as choice is a requirement for a relationship. So, sorry, hatred isn't one of the devil's fruits. Destruction? Yeah, you know, he's a spiritual being. Doesn't have any physical manifestations. And because he's not a physical being, he can't destroy anything. Sorry, you're 0 for 2. As for division, Satan doesn't create division. He is already divided. That's what Yahusha meant by a house divided cannot stand. He is divided, separated from Yahweh. If you are separated from Yahweh, you cannot stand. He is, has been separated. He doesn't separate the rest of us. We do that on our own. Calumny is an interesting word. I love it when calumny comes up in theological discussions, because there is no institution on earth that is more calumnious than religious institutions. It suggests that the old devil is a crafty one, and that he is. But his primary calumnious playground is religion, and he has more and more calumny in Roman Catholicism than any place else. His quote then continues, perhaps its greatest success in these times has been to make us think it doesn't exist. So he's speaking of the devil as an it, not as a he, but as an it. I suspect that's possible because you look at the Roman Catholicism's view of the devil, it very often sees the devil as a woman. And there is an inference relative to the devil, and by the way, the spirits don't have sex, but there is an inference regarding the devil that the devil will manifest, and we typically use himself as it relates to fallen Moloch, because God refers to Halal bin Shakar in the masculine, that's Satan's name, the devil will manifest himself as the whore of Babylon. Whore is a term that we typically ascribe to a female adulteress. So both concepts are okay. It's just odd to hear someone say it as an it doesn't exist. And actually, that is not Satan's greatest success. Satan's greatest success is that he has convinced Muslims and Christians, some 3 billion of them, to believe he's God. That was his intent all along. This book says that everything can be traced to a purely human plan. So he is also suggesting that the devil made me do it. Excuse is a valid one. Now, it is true that the devil does intervene on occasion to influence certain people. Muhammad admitted to being demon-possessed. Paul admitted to being demon-possessed. They are the two, they've had the two greatest influences in human history in terms of corrupting people and leading them away from God. And so on occasion, there is no question that the devil does intervene, and he plays against people's weaknesses to become the wolf dressed in sheep's clothing to lead people astray. And so we do see his influence, but you'll never see his influence in the wheelchair-bound guy, the pilgrim from Mexico, as has been alleged in this case. The Italian newspapers also noted that Pope John Paul II performed an exorcism in 1982, very near the same spot that Francis prayed over the young disabled man on Sunday. Boy, these boys are way too preoccupied with this. Smiling broadly, another article on the same event says the Pope initially shook the man's hand. But in the South American pontiff's expression, it changed dramatically after a priest from the Legionnaires of Christ, a conservative order, leaned in and spoke a few words to him. With a more serious expression on his face, Francis placed both hands on the man's head for 15 seconds. The pilgrim, said to be 43-year-old married man from Mexico called Angelo, then convulsed briefly and emitted a long sigh. His body went limp and his mouth dropped open. Exorcists who have seen the footage have no doubt. This was a prayer from liberation from the devil, an actual exorcism. Yeah, I'm supposed that they blame the devil, too, for the man's paralysis. The Holy Father did not intend to carry out an exorcism, said Father Federico Lombardi, the Vatican spokesman, instead, as he often does for the sick and suffering people, he simply intended to pray for a person who was presented to him. You know, it's I guess it's kind of like here the fascination with the statue that appears to cry, the image of the of Mary on a piece of burnt toast that causes, I think it was even one, the image of Mary, the Madonna and Child, on a tortilla that causes Catholics to go all a-Twitter. It was a real exorcism. If the Vatican has denied this, it shows that they understand nothing, said Father Armuth, who claimed that the Mexican was possessed by four demons. So here's the expert in the subject saying that the Vatican performed an exorcism, but they know nothing, and that the man, this was not an exorcism to cast out a demon, but four demons, and he himself tried to cast out the demons, but was unsuccessful over a long exorcism. But the Pope's 15 seconds of unintentional work did the trick. Father Maspero said that it was particularly symbolic that Francis' purported exorcism occurred on Pentecost, an important feast day for the Church, when the faithful believed Jesus' apostles received the fullness of the Holy Spirit. Of course, this was a Sunday Mass. Pentecost wasn't on Sunday. Nope. But, you know, Roman Catholicism based, you know, Easter always has to be on a Sunday. And so, you know, if you're dealing with Pentecost, it has to be on a Sunday. They've got no concept of how, if Easter's on a Sunday and Pentecost's on a Sunday, that it, you know, it can't be that way. But that's their view of it anyway. And so this was really poignant to them because of this misnomer that Pentecost applied to the Church. Of course, it didn't. There was no Church created. There is no Church in God's parlance. There's no word even remotely related to Church in God's parlance. The Greek word that has been changed to Church is ecclesia. It means called out. It is a somewhat reasonable translation of kara, which is the Hebrew word for call out. And the mikra, which are based on the verb kara, are invitations to be called out and to meet with God. And so what God said on the mikra, which is the mikra of seven Sabbaths, is what is mistaken as Pentecost, is that those who availed themselves of the first three mikrae of Passover, which is the doorway to life, of unyeasted bread, which is the means to resolve the issue of sin and perfect us, and on Bukurim, first fruits, which is our invitation to be adopted into God's family, that on seven Sabbaths, the covenant children are empowered and enriched. It's all about having the mikrae conceive the ecclesia and empower the ecclesia. These things are related. They literally are translations of one another, but by changing ecclesia to Church, all of that was lost. There there was now more than ever a need for exorcists to combat people possessed by sorcerers and Satanists, Father Amorth said. We live in an age when God has been forgotten, and whenever God is not present, the devil reigns. Actually, God is not omnipresent. So if, and I don't, I'm going to be absolutely certain that God has never been in a Roman Catholic Church. But the idea that that people are possessed by sorcerers and Satanists means that people possess people, because sorcerers are people and Satanists are people. Demons are not people. Demons are not sorcerers. Demons are not Satanists. And so this boy is sadly mistaken, and he is the chief exorcist right now for the Roman Catholic Church. He acknowledged that many people, even Catholics, regard exorcism as mumbo-jumbo, but insists they're mistaken. Those who don't believe should read the Gospels. There is no Gospels, by the way. It's a another Christian corruption. Just as church is a Christian corruption, there is no church, there is no cross, there are no Gospels. Nothing even remotely close to a Gospel, nothing remotely close to a church, nothing remotely close to a Trinity, nothing remotely close to a cross is manifest in the eyewitness accounts scribed in Greek. And so this man would be as mistaken in his reference to the Gospels as he would be in referencing Yahusha by the corrupted name Jesus, even in speaking of exorcisms, because that doesn't exist either. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I've got a couple other comments from this article, and then we're going to turn to Glenn, who's called in from Philadelphia. The expert in the Vatican on exorcism said that John Paul II had carried out many exorcisms during his pontificate, but that Benedict XVI had not performed any, instead leaving it to bishops and to priests. Quote, John Paul II fought many times against Satan. Yeah, I guess he was fighting against Satan when he covered up priestly pedophilia so that his priests can continue to ravage young children. Father Amorth said, those battles continue. So even though John Paul is toes up and taking a dirt nap, his battles against Satan continue, according to the Roman Catholic cleric, even though he is dead. In fact, he is present today in many exorcisms. If you cite his name during an exorcism, the person who is possessed literally froths at the mouth in fury. That's kind of funny. That's like saying that the person who is being abused by the devil, when the devil's advocate is cited, the person who is being abused by the devil froths at the mouth. That means that if you're thinking logically, the invocation of the Pope's name causes the victim of demonic possession to be angry. These boys really ought to think before they open their yap. We have Glenn now from Philadelphia. Good morning, Glenn.
Good morning. I was going to address this exorcism story, which really kind of got under my skin.
Yes.
But first, I thought I'd mention you. You spoke of Pentecost, the holiday thing.
Yeah.
Easter always it cracks me up because Easter is, and most Christians don't know this. Like they know that Easter floats around, but they don't know why. Easter
right.
is the first Sunday after the first ecclesiastical full moon after the vernal equinox. I'm
You're right.
That has anything to do with Yahusha, right?
Yeah. And, of course, the timing of Passover is that God says that you determine the first month of the year by the barley harvest, when the ears of grain in the in barley are still pliable, still growing, still receptive. At that point, you pick the new moon, which would be not a black moon, but the beginning of light on the moon surface, because the moon was the only way to actually establish a calendar and before we had mechanization and electricity and that sort of thing. And so the timing is always begins the new moon that is closest to the time that that barley begins to become a beeb ripe. And what that does is that it deals with the fact that the moon phase is 29 and a half days, and so if you just take 12 of those, the year is no longer going to be consistent with the seasons. So God has a method to do that. He says that's the timing, and on the 14th day of the first month, that is Passover. And so that's the is Passover, and then the next day is unyeasted bread, and the next day is Bukkotim, first fruits. Now, Bukkotim, first fruits, is the event that they're actually corrupting to be Easter, but it has absolutely no relevance whatsoever to the day of the week. None.
Right.
Yeah, so the Roman Catholic deal, and by the way, there's another caveat to the Roman Catholic deal that that is also telling. It's not just that it's set by this decree that is inconsistent with Yahweh's testimony. It if Easter should happen to fall on Passover, then Easter is moved.
Oh my goodness! That's interesting.
Yeah, of course. What it tells you is that that the Roman Catholic Church celebration of Easter, which is the celebration of Ishtar in the Babylonian religion, is holy and completely pagan, and that the holiest day on the Christian calendar is absolutely worthless. Rather than pleasing God, that the Easter sunrise services, where you know Ishtar was a sun deity. Rather than pleasing God, it angers him, and that those who celebrate Easter will never see heaven.
Right.
See, that's what it tells you.
That's just the pagan thing is crazy.
Yes.
About the autism, I'm a nurse, and I work with special needs kids, work with a lot of psych patients, neurology patients, and I saw that video, and it really angered me what they did with that. I mean, sometimes if you have like a seizure patient or a brain injured patient, just, you know, physical stimulation or the placing of the hands on the head or sometimes touch, you know, all I saw there was, you know, something akin to like a very transient absent seizure or something, you know, like it looked to me like that was, you know, neurologically based, just some sort of little, you know, seizure behavior or something like that. That's all I saw.
Glenn, first of all, congratulations on working with special needs children. That's an extraordinarily worthy way to devote one's life. But second of all, thank you for that insight. I think that's a lot, has a lot to do also with the alleged healings and the shaking on Benny Hinn revival meetings as well. I think you're correct that this is all imagined.